2. Man Without a Face. The autobiographical self-fashioning of spymaster Marcus Wolf. Mary Beth Stein. East German espionage was legendary under Marcus Wolf, director of the Main Intelligence Directorate, Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, HVA, in the Ministry for State Security, Ministerium für Staatssicherheit, MFS, of the German Democratic Republic. For over 25 years, his physical identity remained a mystery to Western intelligence agencies. Prior to his 1979 exposure by Werner Stiller, one of the highest-ranking HVA officers to defect to the West, Wolf was simply dubbed the Man Without a Face. This moniker became the title of his 1997 English-language autobiography, co-authored with the British journalist Anne McElvoy, and subtitled The Autobiography of Communism's Greatest Spymaster. A revised and expanded German edition appeared the same year with notable differences under the title Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg, Erinnerungen, Spy Boss in the Secret War, Recollections. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fate of the MFS and HVA was unclear. Civil rights groups intervened in January 1990 to prevent the destruction of files from many departments. However, the HVA succeeded in destroying, or in some instances, trading, nearly all its most sensitive files through late spring of that year. Top priority was given to expunging the dossiers of its full-time employees, as well as compromising information about espionage operations that would expose the identity of Stasi agents in the West, known euphemistically in MFS jargon as Enlighteners, Aufklärer, and Scouts of Peace, Kundschafter des Friedens. Consequently, it is impossible to know how much information about foreign intelligence in general and Wolf's life work in particular was lost during this time. There can be little doubt, however, that the systematic purge of Stasi files laid the groundwork for later representations of the HVA by Wolf and others that are difficult to corroborate or disprove. What remains of Wolf's 34-year service record, for example, is limited to roughly 100 pages in three separate files in the archives of the Federal Commissioner for the Records of the State Security Service of the former German Democratic Republic, GDR, the agency that administers the surviving Stasi files. The Man Without a Face might have remained the man without a trace were it not for the seemingly insatiable need to tell his life story after emerging from the shadows. Aptly described by David Childs and Richard Popplewell as a formidable self-publicist, Wolf was a frequent guest in the German media after 1989, fashioning himself in interviews and television shows as a voice for reform inside the Socialist Unity Party, SED, and as the positive face of the MFS. In addition to the two works discussed in this essay, he also authored or collaborated in three other books about himself and his life work during his lifetime that bear his name. In Eigenem Auftrag, On My Own Behalf, 1991. Marcus Wolf, Ich bin kein Spion. Marcus Wolf, I am not a spy, 1992. And Die Kunst der Verstellung, The Art of Deception, 1998. Other books based on interviews and correspondence have appeared posthumously, including Marcus Wolf, Letzte Gespräche, Marcus Wolf, Last Conversations, Schütt, 2007, and Misha, A. Wolf, 2013. The following analysis of Man Without a Face and Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg situates the telling of his life story in the turbulent decade following the collapse of the GDR and identifies strategies of narrative self-fashioning that negotiate reader expectations of personal disclosure and honest self-reflection on the one hand, and the author's need for circumspection on the other. Applying Philippe Lejeune's notion of the autobiographical pact to Wolff's works permits a reading that assumes the author's commitment to telling the truth, while recognizing the impossibility of telling the truth about the self or constituting the self as a complete subject. My approach is not to interrogate truth claims in Wolff's autobiographies, but to examine the spy master's story of himself as a protagonist in the world rather than as a narrative to be verified or falsified. While the paucity of archival sources corroborating or disproving Wolff's truth claims all but necessitates such an approach, this chapter argues that the autobiographical production of high-ranking party officials after German unification offers an important site for critical readings of communist subjectivity in a post-socialist context. Before examining Wolff's presentation of self as unrepentant communist and successful spymaster on the losing side of the Cold War, however, it will be useful to outline in broad strokes the trajectory of his life, details of which stem from his own writings or published interviews with him, unless otherwise indicated. Wolff's life trajectory. The oldest son from playwright Friedrich Wolff's second marriage, Markus Wolff was born in the small town of Hechingen in southwest Germany on January 19, 1923. His brother Konrad, later renowned film director and president of the East German Academy of Arts, was born 2 years later. Friedrich Wolff was Jewish, and both he and his wife were members of the German Communist Party. Consequently, they feared for their lives when Hitler came to power. The Wolff family fled Nazi Germany and arrived in Moscow in 1934, where the 11-year-old Markus attended the Karl Liebknecht School, a school for the children of German-speaking refugees. He became fluent in Russian, joined the Soviet Young Pioneers, and developed a lifelong appreciation for Russian culture and cuisine. Markus finished school and studied aeronautics at the Moscow Institute for Airplane Engineering from 1940 until 1942. In 1942, he was delegated to the Communist International Comintern, where he and other youth from Nazi-occupied territories received political training and prepared for the post-war liberation of their homelands. It is here that Markus met his first wife, Emmy Stenza, daughter of Franz Stenza, the German Communist Party delegate to the Reichstag who was murdered in Buchenwald in 1933. Between 1943 and 1945, Markus worked as a radio commentator for the German People's Radio, Deutsche Volkssender, the voice of the German Communist Party in the Soviet Union. He married Emmy Stenza in 1944, returned to Berlin in May 1945, and worked under the pseudonym Michael Sturm as a commentator and political agitator for the communist-run Berliner Rundfunk, Berlin Radio, from 1946 until 1949. One of his assignments was to cover the Nazi war crimes trial in Nuremberg. In 1949, Wolff was appointed the first German advisor to the newly created diplomatic mission of the GDR in Moscow. He was recalled to East Berlin in 1951 and assigned to the Institute for Economic Scientific Research, the front for East Germany's nascent intelligence agency. In 1952, at the age of 29, he was named director. Less than a year later, the Institute was incorporated into the MFS, Wolf became director of the HVA and deputy to the Minister for State Security, Erich Mielke. He attained the rank of general and remained the number two man in the MFS until his voluntary retirement at the age of 63 in 1986. It is useful to interrupt this outline of Wolf's life to point out that it was fairly uncommon for communist functionaries to retire early, because it typically signaled dysfunction within a department or a falling out of favor. While neither appears to factor in Wolf's case, his early retirement became fodder for speculation in the West, as well as in the East. Wolf writes in his autobiographies that by the early 1980s, he had achieved his professional goals and feared he could no longer hide his skepticism regarding real existing socialism. He raised the subject of retirement with Mielke in 1983, but was forced to wait another 3 years before stepping down. For Mielke, the timing of his deputy's decision to retire was most inopportune, for it coincided with a serious war scare over the stationing of middle-range missiles in East and West Germany and escalating tensions with the Soviets due to Erich Honecker's dogged pursuit of West German recognition of the GDR. The spymaster had to know how inauspicious the moment was, which makes his early retirement all the more intriguing. The death of Wolf's brother, Konrad, the previous year, and the disheartening NATO report obtained by Rainer Rupp, an HVA mole to NATO, on the structural weaknesses of Soviet military and economic power, appear to have been significant factors in his decision. The language citing reasons for his retirement provided Wolf with a strategic exit from a position of power and responsibility. Moreover, it allowed Mielke to assure the East German Politburo as well as the Soviets of an orderly transition in the MFS. The resignation letter, dated October 8, 1986, which survived the systematic destruction of Stasi files, mentions the desire to complete his brother's Troika project and the wish to creatively think through and remember the experiences of his life and work. The plan to write a memoir based on experiences and insights of the last 35 years working as the head of foreign intelligence that incorporates the traditions of our precursors, which could be of use in conveying experiences from the struggles of the last 50 years to later generations, appealed to Mielke and ensured Wolf's access to the HVA archives for his research. With retirement, Wolf received a large new apartment overlooking the Spree River, a driver, a secretary, and an office in the ministry. In return, he agreed to be available in an advisory capacity to Mielke and Wolf's successor, Werner Grossmann, an extraordinary arrangement that undercuts Wolf's carefully crafted self-image as someone outside the system in 1989, when the GDR collapsed. Wolf had another personal reason for asking to be relieved of his duties that is not cited in the resignation letter. His marriage to his second wife, Christel, was falling apart because of his affair with Andrea Stingel, the woman who would become his third wife. Mielke, whom Wolf characterizes as an old-fashioned Puritan in sexual mores, was concerned about avoiding the scandal of divorce and pressured him to remain married for the sake of appearances. He refused. As Wolf's memoirs focus largely on his professional life, it is a significant admission of the entanglement of the personal and professional at this critical juncture when he writes, "With the decision to marry Andrea, I finally supplied Mielke the inducement to initiate my departure." Moreover, the statement gives some credence to Mielke's later claim that Wolf stepped down because of moral transgressions. The fact is, Mielke was even more concerned that a bitter ex-wife might try to blackmail the MFS or could be exploited by Western intelligence agencies intent on damaging the GDR. Fearing a security risk, he went so far as to have his deputy's telephone lines tapped. Continuing with Wolf's life trajectory, in the first years of retirement, Wolf devoted himself to completing Konrad Wolf's manuscript of Die Troika, The Triumvirate, which was unfinished at the time of his death. The story of three friends growing up in the Soviet Union appeared in early 1989 and became the first East German book to deal with crimes under Stalin. Although Konrad was one of the original Troika, Markus benefited from the insinuation that his brother's experiences and views corresponded closely to his own. Indeed, Die Troika can be read as Wolf's earliest foray into autobiography, one that transformed the man without a face into a public figure capable of appealing to younger East Germans. In establishing himself as a credible historical witness to terrible repression under communism, Wolf discovered a successful narrative strategy that he would hone in later memoirs. Around this time, he assumed a more public role through cautious support for Mikhail Gorbachev and Sputnik, the German-language magazine from the Soviet Union banned by the SED in the late 1980s. Buoyed by the positive reception of Die Troika and confident that he could successfully pivot from SED insider to a spokesperson for reform, Wolf agreed to speak at the November 4, 1989 mass rally on East Berlin's Alexander Square. He completely misjudged the political climate, as well as the extent of his personal appeal, and was booed off the stage after identifying himself as a retired general in the MFS and denouncing the scapegoating of the Stasi as the whipping boys of the nation. The crowd on the Alexander Square was in no mood for lectures from a Stasi officer less than 1 month after mass arrests and Stasi and police violence against protesters on the 40th anniversary of the founding of the GDR. Years later, in a September 28, 2002 article of Neues Deutschland, Wolf would recall, "I felt connected to those who demanded change, but the political climate changed after November 4th. In my second book, On My Own Behalf, I grapple with feelings of guilt, complicity, and responsibility for the things that had happened." East Germany's peaceful revolution forced the SED from power 5 days after the Alexander Square rally. Mielke's arrest in December was followed by the failure of a bill to pass in the Bundestag that would have granted amnesty to Stasi officers and agents. Wolf realized that he and others would not be able to escape their Stasi past. Fearing imminent arrest, he and his wife, Andrea, left on an extended holiday to Austria just a few days before German unification. They moved from place to place like some German Bonnie and Clyde before fleeing to the Soviet Union with the aid of his KGB contacts. The Soviet Union in the turbulent years of 1990 to 1991 was not the sanctuary where the Wolfs had hoped to find advice and peace. His presence was awkward for the Kremlin and colleagues in the KGB. Direct and indirect appeals asking Gorbachev to raise the possibility of amnesty for Wolf in unification negotiations with German Chancellor Kohl went unanswered. Wolf feared extradition and realized he could not count on the KGB or the Soviet Union for help. Following the political turmoil after the abortive coup against Gorbachev in August 1991, he and his wife left for Vienna and turned themselves in to the Austrian police after an unsuccessful bid for Austrian asylum. Wolf's lawyer and German prosecutors arranged for an orderly arrest at the German-Austrian border. The spymaster spent much of the 1990s in the public eye. On trial, defending himself in courtrooms as well as in the court of public opinion, he lived in Berlin, writing and giving interviews until his death on November 9, 2006, and was buried next to his brother in the Gedenkstätte der Sozialisten, Memorial to the Socialists, in the Berlin city district of Lichtenberg. Communist autobiography after 1989. In considering why the man without a face would abandon a lifelong habitus built around secrecy to write and rewrite the self over the course of a decade, it is important to recall the exigencies of the moment of his writing. The dramatic collapse of the East German state constituted a traumatic rupture for SED party leaders and a significant challenge to their political self-understanding. What followed was a period of existential uncertainty, as many faced public condemnation and criminal prosecution. The first to be put on trial, paradoxically, was not SED party elites responsible for abuses of power in the GDR, but border guards who had been involved in shootings at the Berlin Wall and along the German-German border. In the most high profile of the Wall trials, General Secretary Erich Honecker and five other high-ranking party members were indicted in 1992 for indirect complicity in manslaughter. By the time Wolf went on trial for the first time in 1993, German public opinion was sharply divided over the ability of the West German legal system to redress GDR-era injustice. This polarized political context had a profound impact on how high-ranking party officials remembered and narrated communist experience. Indeed, Wolf spoke for many East Germans, and not just former SED elites, at his own trial when he protested, "Not everything in the 40-year history of the GDR was bad and worthy of erasure, and not everything in the West good and just. This period of historical upheaval cannot be dealt with adequately through the clichés of a just state on the one hand and an unjust state on the other." The fusion of personal story and political history was a common feature of communist autobiography in GDR times. And this way of seeing oneself in the world persisted for many after the Wende, the period leading up to and including the fall of the Berlin Wall. After 1989, some SED elites turned to life writing as a way of coming to terms with the collapse of the GDR and entering into public debates about the East German past. Life writing became a vehicle for defending oneself against accusation and preserving a usable communist past. According to historian Martin Sabro, the belief that the communist past could be narrated, that is, had not been discredited by war and genocide, explains the remarkable propensity for communist autobiography after 1989. In contrast to Nazi party leaders after 1945, former SED elites believed that, despite the GDR's spectacular collapse, their lives could be defended as an upright life lived in error. The first spate of communist autobiographies after 1989, as publisher Christoph Links notes, were penned by second-tier officials and published with leftist publishers in the former GDR. These paved the way for the memoirs by high-ranking party officials who were actually responsible for the policies of the regime. Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg is an example of the latter that appeared with a formerly West German publisher. Although Wolf's 1986 resignation letter attests to literary ambitions predating the collapse of the GDR, his prolific autobiographical production after 1989 is inextricably linked to the political and legal fallout he faced following the collapse of the East German state. He began work on Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg while in Russian exile for the second time in his life, with the prospect of criminal prosecution and the criminalization of the HVA weighing heavily on him. What followed then was the criminal prosecution, the confrontation with the victor. I felt obligated to convey not only my own position, but also speak for my colleagues, the scouts of peace who were in prison. This had a determining influence on the content of later books, including my memoir, Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg. As the preceding excerpt illustrates, Wolf's autobiographical writing begins first and foremost as a defense for himself, as well as colleagues and agents of the HVA facing prosecution. Man Without a Face and Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg appeared in 1997, while Wolf was a defendant in the second of two highly publicized trials in Düsseldorf. The 1993 trial for treason, espionage, and bribery began under intense media scrutiny and concluded after 7 months with a guilty verdict and a 6-year sentence. The Federal Constitutional Court overturned the verdict 2 years later, arguing that former East Germans could not be guilty of treason against the Federal Republic. Wolf was convicted again in 1997 on charges of kidnapping, bodily injury, and coercion in the 1950s and 1960s, crimes that occurred in the GDR and were punishable under East German law. He received a suspended 2-year sentence. As a defendant, Wolf denounced the trials as a farce and an example of Siegerjustiz, victor's justice, that is, politically motivated injustice exacted by the winners from the losers of a struggle. His autobiographies continue this line of reasoning, for example, when declaring that West German courts are primarily interested in the settling of accounts to ensure that only one version of history prevails. Written for different audiences, and with slightly different emphases, the German and English language autobiographies analyzed in this essay constitute, as I argue, part of Wolf's public relations campaign for personal exoneration and a more positive assessment of East German communism in the intensely politicized climate of post-unification Germany. His memoirs are intended as a counter-history to the prevailing discourse about the end of the Cold War, out of the belief, as he writes in the preface to Man Without a Face, that any history worthy of the name cannot be written only by the victors. From Spymaster to Master Storyteller. Like most communist autobiographers before and after 1989, Wolf aligns his life story with the history of the GDR and invokes the anti-fascist founding myth that was the cornerstone of East Germany's claim of legitimacy. The rejection of Nazism and political socialization during Soviet exile inform his life work and give it meaning. The Second World War was the crucial event in the lives of millions of people, and it was a war that thankfully ended the Third Reich. How could anyone who fought against Hitler's barbarians have considered himself a traitor to Germany? My own contribution and that of my family to the fight may have been small, but I am proud of it nonetheless. Reprising his defense at the 1993 trial, this statement deftly equates persecution of communists under the Nazis with the criminalization of SED officials after 1989. For Wolf, combating the revival of fascism justifies his foreign intelligence work during the Cold War. In Man Without a Face, he writes, "Hitler's long shadow was one of the reasons I agreed to the idea of working for a secret service. This was not treason." Although the HVA continued the GDR's fight against fascism after 1945 on a less exalted level than those who resisted Hitler, He is proud of his part in maintaining the status quo in Europe, a status quo that may have been tense and chilly, but which ultimately avoided the unthinkable but not always improbable endgame of nuclear war. This line of reasoning echoes East German claims that the Berlin Wall prevented a Third World War and saved the peace in Europe. Wolf employs a narrative strategy that burnishes his reputation and that of his scouts on the one hand, while normalizing and justifying East German espionage on the other. The successful spymaster, who built an extensive spy network that infiltrated the inner circles of West German political parties and the upper echelons of industry, the military, and technology in the Federal Republic, depicts the HVA as a dedicated and elite corps serving an honorable cause. He praises the political idealism and resourcefulness of his scouts and reflects with pride on the work of his top spies, Gabriele Gast in West Germany's Federal Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, Günter Guillaume in the Brandt administration, and Rainer Rupp in NATO's Brussels headquarters. While attributing the success of the HVA to a strong sense of belonging that he cultivated among his scouts, Wolf acknowledges that it also inadvertently led to the exposure and arrest of Günter Guillaume when a telegram reading, "Congratulations on the second man," on the occasion of Guillaume's son's birth, caught the attention of West German counterintelligence. Wolf depicts himself as a compassionate spymaster, personally committed to his agents and concerned about their welfare, when he writes, "I never forgot that behind every case was a human being who had put his trust in us and his life on the line." He describes the arrest and conviction of Gabriele Gast as a particularly hard blow in a period rich in personal disappointments and defeats, and wonders whether espionage is worth the human toll when confronted with the poor health of former moles and agents of his who were forced to testify at his trial. However, when it comes to victims of the HVA's particular methods of psychological manipulation, he has little regret about the active measures that damaged political reputations in the West and feels no guilt over seducing, intimidating, or blackmailing people into spying for the GDR. In justifying East German espionage, Wolf wants readers to believe that the HVA was like other foreign intelligence agencies and better than many. In the preface to Man Without a Face, he acknowledges, "Our sins and mistakes were those of every other intelligence agency," and asserts that crimes were committed on both sides in the global struggle. East German foreign intelligence bore greatest similarity to the Soviet Union's KGB, on which it was modeled, and from which its operatives received training in the early years. The HVA was predicated on the same Czechist principles and was integrated into the MFS following a similar arrangement in the Soviet Union. According to Wolf, however, it also operated like intelligence agencies in the West. For example, he argues that disinformation campaigns designed to discredit the West through the German people's radio had parallels in the CIA-backed Radio Free Europe. The HVA appears more professional and scrupulous in Wolf's account than others because he claims to have guarded it against the operational excesses of some Eastern Bloc intelligence agencies that resulted in wet jobs, a euphemism for illegal, unauthorized killings in espionage that did and still do occur. While acknowledging that espionage had become a rough game, Wolf claims to have eschewed the use of nerve toxins and deadly skin poisons developed and disseminated to Eastern Bloc intelligence agencies by the KGB. As head of foreign espionage, Wolf's primary responsibility was for the operational area of the Federal Republic of Germany. But as Jens Giesecke and Mike Dennis argue, this does not mean the HVA was completely removed from domestic surveillance and political repression in the GDR. Nonetheless, that is precisely the impression Wolf creates when he writes, "I considered my own work in foreign intelligence to be a separate and more defensible sphere of activity." Both the German and the English language editions gloss over the degree of collaboration between the HVA and other departments in the MFS. Omitting or downplaying episodes in which the HVA participated in political repression at home allows Wolf to represent himself as he would most like to be known, the indefatigable adversary of the West during the Cold War, who was deeply committed to defending the East German state. He recounts how the HVA recruited West German businessmen and politicians, pressing them into cooperation through extortion, probing them for critical information about West German economic and political policies, and passing this information along to the KGB. He regrets that Guillaume's exposure brought down the most far-sighted of modern German statesmen, Willy Brandt, but believes Guillaume was the pretext for, rather than the cause of, Brandt's downfall. Indeed, he maintains that intelligence verifying Brandt's genuine commitment to Ostpolitik contributed to a climate of détente because it reduced KGB and MFS fears of West Germany. Whether or not this was the case, such an argument has the effect of trivializing the harm done to the West by the HVA without diminishing Wolf's mystique as communism's successful spymaster. Wolf is comparatively silent, however, about HVA participation in domestic surveillance and political repression in the GDR. Structural overlap is blamed for information sharing and collaboration between the HVA and other departments of the MFS. He does not disavow knowledge of the harsh methods of counterintelligence, but provides little detail on the exact nature or extent of the HVA's involvement, other than to state, "I am not going to claim I had nothing to do with domestic repression, but the relatively strict compartmentalization of the ministry meant that my service was explicitly not supposed to engage in internal counterintelligence activities." Vague denials or tacit admissions of the kind in the preceding quote do little to shed light on the blurred boundaries between defense of the East German state from the incursions of the West and repression of East German citizens who wanted to reform socialism in the GDR or immigrate to the West. Lacking in specificity, they allow Wolf to obfuscate his awareness of, responsibility for, and role in political repression in general. In addition to drawing a bright line between foreign intelligence and domestic surveillance, Wolf draws sharp contrasts between himself and Erich Mielke. Described by Leslie Collett as exact opposites in almost every way, the HVA chief was cultured, well-connected, and came from the ranks of the party intelligentsia, whereas Mielke rose from proletarian street brawler and German Communist Party member in the Third Reich to the upper echelons of power in East Germany as a member of the SED's Central Committee. Wolf depicts his boss as a volatile but shrewd political operator who was envious of his deputy and regarded him as a potential rival. The level of distrust between the two men in Wolf's account strains credulity at times. For example, when Wolf claims he resisted his boss's demand for total control and was able to effectively insulate the HVA's central registration system. Another implausible claim is that Mielke kept the HVA chief out of the loop about plans to build the Berlin Wall in 1961. Even at the risk of damaging his reputation as the man who really knew what was going on in East Germany, Wolf claims that he first heard the news about the border closing on the radio like everyone else. Jens Giesecke also questions the veracity of this statement, as there was greater overlap in areas of responsibility and more coordination between departments of the MFS than Wolf admits. By recounting their personal differences and moments of their contentious work relationship, Wolf creates the impression that struggles with Mielke contributed to the decision to retire early. His belief that Mielke would have blocked his candidacy for election to the Central Committee and the Politburo is essentially unprovable, but it allows him to appear as the victim of political intrigue and power struggles within the MFS. His long tenure as head of the HVA is attributed to deep personal connections to the highest levels of the KGB, which protected him from Mielke's paranoia and lust for power. The spymaster had the good fortune to retire before the collapse of East German communism. This gives him some credibility when assuming a critical stance regarding the GDR past. In his autobiographies, he distances himself not only from his boss, but also from an SED leadership resistant to reform. He employs the pejorative term concrete heads for the octogenarian SED leaders of a moribund regime and recounts trying to battle against Erich Honecker's recalcitrance in a private meeting in which the general secretary vowed he would never allow perestroika and glasnost in the GDR. However, Wolf's support for Gorbachev was not as unqualified as he would have readers think. In a March 1989 interview with the West German news agency ARD, Wolf equivocated when asked about the suitability of perestroika and glasnost for the GDR, saying, "Here, in the GDR, we must do what we consider to be right and necessary for us." In the same interview, he confined his support for Gorbachev to, "I am cheerful and happy that he is there." There presumably refers to the Soviet Union. Another possible translation for "das es ihn gibt" might be "that he is alive." Either way, the comments reveal a reluctance to fully embrace Gorbachev's reforms and openly break with the policies of the Honecker regime. In recalling how he was reprimanded for his public support of Gorbachev's perestroika, Wolf casts himself as an uncomfortable outsider at odds with the party he did not abandon, while intellectually drawn to dissident groups that did not embrace him. Claiming that some regarded him in the late 1980s as a reformer inside the party, he acknowledges that he and others in the party waited in vain for a redeemer to emerge as a successor to Honecker from within the system and set a new course. While self-critical admissions like this implicate him in the inertia of a regime incapable of adjusting to new realities, they also illustrate how Wolf attempts to understand his mistakes and his role in maintaining the East German state.